Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and judging by your comments from last week's broadcast, we brought on one of our favorite guests, Layla Mutin. She's our nutritionist at the Hoffman Center, and a lot of people were real happy to hear her participate in the podcast, so we're going to bring her on as a regular feature because, well, that's her forte, nutrition. And we've got lots of questions. Many of you are emailing us questions. We invite your questions at radioprogram@AOL.com. Please make your questions pithy and to the point, because if you provide us with a 24-page medical history, it's a little less likely that we're going to be able to answer your question in detail. So without further ado, let's introduce Layla Mutin. Layla is the nutritionist at the Hoffman Center. She is a registered dietitian. She also has a master's degree in nutrition, and we work together on a daily basis helping patients. So welcome again to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Nice having you aboard.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you so much.
And by the way, you just sent me, you are the editor-in-chief of the Hoffman Center News, a.k.a. the Intelligent Medicine Newsletter, and you just sent me my e-version of the Intelligent Medicine Newsletter. It looks great. My contribution is about something that just happened in the news, which I'll talk about in a little greater detail probably on Health Talk over the weekend, but it has to do with George Bush and his new stent. He was rushed apparently to the hospital after an abnormal angiogram and was given a metal stent in one of his coronary arteries, and I have some things to say about that and the nature of American medicine that takes healthy individuals like this and unnecessarily provides them with stent procedures. And I've got medical documentation and studies to back me up on that point. And your contribution is also great because, well, what did you talk about in this week's newsletter?
Well, I talked about the dangers of very low cholesterol. Our mainstream medicine has always been trying to get levels of cholesterol lower and lower and lower. I mean, just 20 years ago, if you had an LDL of 130, it was okay. But now, wow, they don't like to see it much over 70, do they?
Mm-hmm. And in fact, we actually saw a patient together, very, very, very nice lady, who came to see us all the way from, I believe it was Charleston, South Carolina. And, she was from Savannah, Georgia, I believe.
That's
she
right,
was,
yes.
She was from, right, she was from Savannah, Georgia. And, she came to see us, at her son's behest. She's 91 years old. She didn't look a day over 80, right?
That's true. I could not have guessed her age, no.
It was funny because I said, you know, you don't look your age. And she looked at me very seriously and she said, why, do I look older? but she was sharp as a tack, and she was in good condition, and she had high blood pressure, and legitimately she was on several blood pressure medications to keep her blood pressure under control, and I get that, and I understand the importance of that. However, for some reason, she had been placed on a very high dose of a statin drug, inappropriately, because here she was, free of cardiovascular disease, possibly at risk, but at 91, you made it to 91, do you really need to be on 80 milligrams of simvastatin to get your cholesterol down to 110? I'm not sure that really is good medicine.
Yeah, and you know, the research has been there for greater than 20 years that people with the mid-200s, women especially, fare much better health-wise, mm-hmm. have an overall smaller risk of mortality than when they're lowered this way. So I could not understand why she was on that much simvastatin at all. And, you know, exactly what you said. When you get to a certain age, you're not going to need that stuff anymore. If you haven't already dropped from a heart attack or something,
right.
You don't need the stuff.
And we're not being cynical or fatalistic about this. Like, you know, the people past a certain age, you know, throw granny under the bus or, you know, you're expendable. Studies actually do show that there may be a benefit, especially for middle-aged men who are at a vulnerable time in their life when men may develop premature cardiovascular disease. And therefore, it may be effective, although it's not, you know, that clearly established, that lowering cholesterol preventively in healthy individuals may confer some benefit. But the proposition that we should give all healthy individuals with high cholesterol cholesterol-lowering drugs, it's highly dubious. It's been challenged again and again in the scientific literature, and it doesn't make sense. And, you know, it'd be one thing if these medications didn't cause side effects, but they do. People complain of, you know, if they're not overtly in pain with muscle aches, if they don't have elevated liver function tests that make it, threaten their liver function. They may be devitalized, tired. They may have difficulty focusing. They may have dementia-like symptoms even.
Exactly. And some more research is showing us that in women, that Lipitor may bring on diabetes.
Yeah, right. So, resulted in a black box warning on statin drugs that, quote, the use of this drug may increase your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So we trade one problem for another, and clearly diabetes isn't great for the very self-same heart that we're trying to protect by lowering cholesterol. So
it's endemic. So all things considered, she shouldn't be on that statin, right?
Right. Anyway, so that just as an aside, and that's a very nice article that you wrote, and you have some really good evidence. So the way to get a hold of our newsletter, if you haven't already subscribed, radioprogram@AOL.com, write to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's an email address. And simply request the newsletter. And while you're at it, you might provide us with a question, something that you want us to talk about here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcasts. So anyway, this first question, this is going to be like a high-hanging curveball for you that you can hit out of the park. I want to make it easy on you here. All right, more challenging questions coming up later, but this one's going to be right in your sweet spot. This is a person who's actually requesting the newsletter. It's from Marie. She says, I would like to receive your newsletter. So she gives us her email address and we'll put her on the subscription list. She says, hi, I love the new podcasts. I have a medical question I hope you find worthy of discussion on the show. It relates to feelings of hunger, which become more intense during and after a meal. She writes, I frequently experience feelings of extreme hunger during and immediately after meals. Mm-hmm. Especially breakfast, which encourages me to eat more. If I wait a bit after eating, the feeling of hunger tends to subside about 20 minutes after the meal. However, the feeling of satiety doesn't last very long. I often become very hungry and feel weak and fatigued within another 2 hours or so and need to eat again. This is a predictable response if I eat a meal high in carbohydrates, e.g. waffles, a bagel, or oatmeal. I expect it has something to do with blood sugar levels. However, it also happens when I eat a higher protein breakfast. I do not drink fruit juice or sugary sodas at all. Do you have any insights as to what could be causing this reaction and how I should be eating to avoid it? I'm a perimenopausal woman, age 50, 5'8", and weigh 170 pounds.
Well, she's obviously experiencing some unstable blood sugar or hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, being caused by a meal high in carbohydrates. As she described, she says, this is a predictable response if I eat a meal high in carbohydrates like waffles, a bagel, or oatmeal. And by the way, does everybody know that a bagel is 5 slices of bread? Yes, you heard me right.
Wow.
It's 5 slices of bread, not like back in 1970 when it was the size of a hockey puck.
Mm-hmm.
That was a serving of bread. Anyway, so this... Normally, we see this happen in those who are eating a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of starches, the cereal in the morning, or the toast, the bagel, the waffle, even a bowl of oatmeal for many people may be problematic. What happens is it causes a surge in blood sugar and then a subsequent surge in insulin to bring that blood sugar back to normal. But because the surge of the blood sugar was probably higher than usual or as normal, there is an overshoot of insulin that's being secreted by the pancreas, causing that blood sugar not just to return to normal, but to drop lower than it was before. And when our blood sugar is low, it's time to eat. So that's why an hour or two after a plate of pasta or a sugary breakfast, a cold cereal breakfast kind of a thing, a lot of people do experience hunger.
And that's why, following in the footsteps of the late, great Dr. Robert Atkins, we do glucose tolerance tests on most of our patients. And often, even there's actually a relatively thin young woman the other day where we found a high degree of insulin production, overproduction of insulin. And, you know, typically when people come in for the test, we check their blood sugar, and it might be 85 or 90. And after taking an enormous gulp of sugar, you know, we give them a sugar challenge. Within 2-3 hours, their blood sugar might be 30, 35 points lower. So it's almost as if the act of eating is futile in terms of establishing a better blood sugar. It actually, they actually go backwards after eating in terms of their blood sugar control.
Right, right. And you know what's very interesting is most people think, well, I'm not overweight. I don't have any blood sugar issues. You don't have to be overweight. As your perfect example of this woman, Dr. Hoffman, she had a BMI of 19 or 20,
which
is like perfect.
Yeah, that's not the one who wrote this question.
No, this
one here is age 50, 5'8", 170 mm-hmm. pounds. You know, let's face it, 170 pounds? I mean, I personally weigh less than 170 pounds, and I'm a guy, and I'm about 5'11". So 170 pounds on that 5'8" frame, even though it's relatively tall for a woman, probably some degree of excess mid-abdominal fat that is associated with insulin resistance. I predict a woman like this would have not only hypoglycemia on her glucose tolerance test, but she'd have elevated levels of insulin. We could measure that. And that insulin goes to work on lowering blood sugar and causing hypoglycemia. It also goes to work socking away the fat around your midsection, keeping it from losing weight.
Exactly. And especially in a perimenopausal woman.
Yeah.
And
it might drive blood pressure up, and it might drive especially triglycerides up and mess up the cholesterol profile. All kinds of problems ensue. So, I mean, this sounds like, a day in the life at the Hoffman Center. You know, we see tons of patients like this. This is fairly typical.
Mm-hmm.
So, what strategies would you employ for? Now, she does note. I mean, she says she listens to the podcast and she knows where I'm coming from and where you're coming from. She says that in spite of her efforts to eat protein, she says, "I've tried 2 hard-boiled eggs with a piece of whole wheat toast and a small piece of fruit, and it doesn't seem to help."
Well, there's the thing. And what we thought might be helpful in terms of if you're going to have some carbohydrates in the morning to add some protein to it may help with blood sugar, but obviously not in her case and many cases. So her undoing is not that she's eating the hard-boiled eggs. Those are perfect. But the whole wheat toast and the fruit together may be too much carbohydrate for her.
Right.
And it's still causing that surge in blood sugar and insulin and then that drop in blood sugar that she's experiencing. If I was a betting person, I would bet if she just had the eggs and not much else, she would be fine.
I also find that sometimes these people look for one meal to turn it all around for them. And if you've got a high insulin metabolism, it's going to take a while for you to coax your insulin downward because your body's overproducing it. And even with a protein meal, it still might overproduce it for a while, for, a week or two, or even, for a couple of months until you re-regulate your blood sugar metabolism. It doesn't happen overnight. It may take a while to adjust. And some people go through pangs of withdrawal. They really do as they go to a higher protein, low-carb diet.
Well, there is a such thing as carbohydrate withdrawal. It's absolutely real.
Yep.
And it builds character fast.
And, what I say to these patients is, they complain. I say, we can give you chromium and we can give you a CM-CoR, which is a berberine product, which sensitizes the insulin receptors. And you take fish oil and magnesium and gymnema, silvestri, all these natural supplements. But ultimately, you're going to have to stare that green-eyed monster in the face. And, it's a question of, personal fortitude and a little bit of restraint and discipline.
Absolutely. And what will serve as a motivator if they really stick with it is they'll find that any belly fat that's there or any insulin resistance fat that's there starts to melt away.
Yeah.
It does happen.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful. It's not all about being middle-aged and this is what happens when you're middle-aged. No. No.
Don't accept
it. Doesn't have to be that way.
Don't accept it. All right. This another question comes to us from Len. Len writes to radioprogram@AOL.com. Dear Dr. Hoffman, I like all your vitamins and supplements, but need to know specifically which may be detrimental to my kidney function. I am 70 years old, and every year my creatinine is going up. He says it's now 1.9, and my GFR is going down. That's glomerular flow rate. That's another measure of kidney function. It's now 46. I fear dialysis and transplants. Thanks, Len. So, you know, we see a fair number of people who have the beginnings of kidney troubles.
Yeah.
And so, just for our listening audience, a creatinine of 1.9 is too high. That's a very sensitive measure of declining kidney function. If it's above 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, it's getting up there, and then you can calculate GFR, glomerular flow rate, and we like to see that above 60, 70 in a healthy individual, maybe in a young individual who's got perfect kidney function, you know, over 100. So, so what do we say to Lynn? What are some considerations?
Well, first of all, I would like to know if he's on any blood pressure medications, which may be adversely impacting this a little bit.
Sure, and that is considered, especially diuretics. Diuretics
HCTZ or something. Yeah, LASIK.
Too much LASIK. Sometimes these can actually mess up your kidney function. There are many things that can mess up kidney function. You could have a kidney disease. You could have diabetes and or hypertension. You could even have some kind of urinary problem, like an enlarged prostate, which is causing flow to back up in your kidneys, damaging your kidneys. So that's a not uncommon problem. So, you know, the different factors there. But, you know, let's presume that this is a guy who's on the correct medications, and, you know, sometimes as people age for one reason or another, their kidney function is declining. So, you know, one of the things I often say on my program is, you know, vitamins and minerals are so safe that the vast majority of people, even if they make mistakes when they go to the health food store and buy everything off the shelf, at the very least, you know, they may be wasting their money and not getting the most effective supplements, but it's unlikely that it's going to do them major harm. But with somebody with kidney problems, you can get into trouble. So what are some considerations?
Well, we would have to be careful a bit, I think, with magnesium. Certainly this person may actually need more vitamin D because their vitamin D levels would be low if their kidneys are compromised.
Mm-hmm. We often see that, yep.
So those are the first things I would look at. I would want a full dietary assessment to see how this person is eating. If this gentleman is diabetic, first of all, we need to reverse that trend. And diabetes, as we know, is reversible. We don't just manage it here at the Hoffman Center. We reverse it, and in most cases, we are able to do so. So that would be the first thing. That might bring his kidney function back into onto a better trend.
Another thing to watch out for, often these patients get excess potassium.
Mm.
Particularly, you know, if a patient's had creatinine is 3, 4, 5, you know, potassium may go up, and it's they actually have to go on low-potassium diets. What might that entail?
Oh, getting off a lot of produce, for instance, not having orange, baked potatoes, strawberries, many of the greens that have a lot of potassium, some avocado. So we would watch the potassium levels that way. Now, certainly if this was a patient who's in end-stage renal failure, we have to go even further than that, and we have to look at phosphorus and so forth and everything.
That
so
might be at a creatinine of like 3, 4, 5, 6 or something.
Yeah.
But so you know, you and I have discussed this very often, is we are both critics of the standard renal diet, the diet that's often prescribed for patients because they're supposed to not get potassium. So they basically end up eating white bread and white rice and, you know, starchy
foods. Which makes the diabetes worse, makes the kidney function worse.
Right. And they're also on very low protein diets because, the kidneys do filter out protein. And patients who are on dialysis or patients who have really bad kidney function, they have trouble filtering out the toxic breakdown products of protein. So they're often put on very, very ultra-low protein diets. And good idea, bad idea?
Not a great idea, because we also do know that there is an increased need for protein. And there was even a mouse study done on compromised renal function in mice, and they were able to turn that around on a low carbohydrate diet, meaning a higher protein. It could be a higher fat diet rather than a higher protein diet, but definitely a lower carbohydrate diet. That's been shown. So that's something. That would be something. The low protein diet is not necessarily great. And just to come back to end-stage renal, even there's no such thing as a no-protein diet for these patients. They have to get at least 50% of their protein requirement from high biological value sources, meaning animal sources primarily. not necessarily vegetable sources. So
right. And many of these patients, because their kidneys are not functioning well, they may actually lose protein. And
yes.
So in their bloodstream, they have low levels of albumin. They're like leaking protein through their kidneys. And so we actually want to gently support protein metabolism, not mm-hmm. overload them. You know, these are not people who are going to be eating 22-ounce sirloin steaks and gobbling up, you know, vats of protein powder. That may be overloading the kidneys. But we need a moderate approach, because if we substitute too many carbs for the healthy proteins, the people are going to become more diabetic, overweight, mm-hmm. and insulin resistant, which, you know, is definitely going to mess up their kidney function.
Yeah.
So, but in general, most of the supplements, I think, would be good. Specifically for Len, things that help people who have poor kidney function, I would say fish oil. Fish oil is very beneficial for people who have, especially inflammatory disorders of the kidneys, you know, autoimmune things, glomerulonephritis, but in general, very safe and good for people with poor kidney function. As you mentioned, vitamin D. We actually test magnesium levels. Some patients with kidney problems have low magnesium, some have high, which is why it's important to test.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrients that seem to protect the kidneys, N-acetylcysteine or NAC seems to protect, coenzyme Q10. Many of these patients are very low in carnitine. They just seem to lose their carnitine, and carnitine actually helps to provide them with an energy boost if they have chronic renal failure. So, I think this argues for a custom nutritional program from a medically aware nutritionist. I mean, I think one of the things, sometimes I really kind of hated my medical training because, you know, they kept propagandizing me to use this or that or the other drug, but it sure gave me an understanding of what drugs do and what serious medical conditions do to people's nutritional requirements. So I'm like more attuned to some of the do's and don'ts when it comes to giving people supplements.
That's true. That's true. And with any medication, we have to watch any interaction with supplements. But we also have to watch what nutrients they deplete in the body. We have to be careful of that. So.
Yeah, and many of these patients are on multiple drugs,
mm-hmm.
and they're very depleted. So, but here's another one I think it would be important for. I would be curious to see what Len's homocysteine is.
Oh, yeah.
Because in many of these patients, why don't you talk about the homocysteine connection patients with kidney problems?
Yeah, homocysteine, well, I have to wonder whether it's the chicken or the egg first, whether it's a high homocysteine, a chronically high homocysteine, causing trouble with the kidneys, and then vice versa, that it's not able to metabolize properly back to methionine. But that's more or less happening in the liver. So I think the high homocysteine itself can cause kidney trouble later on if it's not addressed. And it could be addressed quite simply with taking some B12, folate, some B6, trimethylglycine. We like to test for these levels first as well. And often, in many patients that we find with a high homocysteine and kidney problems, their B12 is low, their folate is low, their B6 is low. So, you know, this is all par for the course, but homocysteine is very, very important. I don't think enough doctors look at that, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah, I think what happened was they did for a while they were interested, but then they did one single study which looked at patients who had already pretty advanced heart disease, and they gave them B vitamins, and what they found is it didn't make a difference. So they figured, okay, let's forget about this homocysteine thing because it just doesn't make any difference. And one of the reasons it didn't make a difference is they probably started too late with these patients. These patients are too far gone.
Yeah.
They did it for too short a time, and they were just looking at heart problems. If they had been looking for other types of circulatory problems like dementia or the risk of strokes or TIAs, brain brownouts, circulatory problems, they might have noticed more problems there. We know that the small blood vessels are involved when homocysteine is high. And, you know, perhaps the large coronary arteries are less effective. That's why taking B vitamins once you have blockages in your heart may not make that much of a difference. So they kind of threw out that whole hypothesis without looking at its, you know, the fine points.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that, you know, basic guidelines for Len. I'm acting like I'm on my radio program here. Let's talk to Carolyn. All right, Carolyn, you're next. Okay, no, actually, this is just Carolyn's email. Uh-huh. Carolyn emails us at radioprogram@AOL.com. I am a 65-year-old female. My DHEA level was 136, taking 25 milligrams of DHEA. As soon as I started to take DHEA, I felt a difference in my energy level and overall well-being. I also noticed that my skin seemed to have a renewed glow. I have a new holistic doctor who was terrific. I can't believe it. She's not seeing me. She actually has... Okay, I'll admit there are people out there besides me who are terrific. I'm just kidding. I have been having some back problems and arthritic conditions. So I have been taking 50 milligrams of DHEA. My latest level reading was 577. He said that's fine, but the blood work range is 148 to 246 for my age. Do you agree with my doctor that this is okay? I feel great and have no side effects whatsoever. I really miss you not being on the radio every day. I would appreciate your opinion. Thanks for your newsletter. I look forward to receiving it. Carolyn, so what do we say to Carolyn about DHEA? So here's, I mean, to boil it down, Carolyn is taking more DHEA than I would usually give to a female. And her levels on the blood test are a little bit high. But she feels really good with it. And so the question is, do you adjust the DHEA to the blood work range, or do you let her stay on DHEA? So, you know, what do you think?
Well, if she suffers from autoimmune conditions, those people feel fantastic on a lot of DHEA. Not necessarily a lot of the oral supplement, but when their serum levels are higher than usual. So that's really the first thing I would want to know. If she has rheumatoid arthritis or other autoimmune conditions, I know personally a friend of mine who suffers with lupus, polymyositis. She can't be without DHEA ever.
Well, you know, they have tried to patent DHEA as a conventional drug. I think it actually is on the regular drug formulary for specifically lupus, for an autoimmune disease. And believe it or not, the dose that they used in women, because it's predominantly women who have lupus, it's about, you know, 5-to-1 or 10-to-1 women predominance. The dose they used in a Stanford study was 200 milligrams a day. That's what it took to get them to feel optimal. And it worked very well. It really provided a lot of symptom relief. A few of the women reported side effects. So because it has a masculinizing effect, it can cause a little bit of facial hair. It can cause a little bit of acne, especially at those high doses. But as you know, I tend to dose women anywhere from 5, maybe up to 25. I rarely have women on 50. We don't seem to need that much. Men, I personally take 50 milligrams a day myself. I don't see a need for more. I don't know, maybe I'd be supercharged if I took 100 or 200, but I don't see the need for that. Blood levels provide us with a guide because we don't want it to go through the roof. And theoretically, there might be a risk for a woman who has recently had breast cancer, has active breast cancer. We might be a little concerned because it has a slight estrogenic effect. For a man who has active prostate cancer or is high risk for prostate cancer, we might have a concern with excessive levels of DHEA because it can sometimes be converted to testosterone. But ordinarily, it's very well tolerated. And, you know, this whole business of her saying overall well-being, energy level, DHEA is an energizer. It's also a great antidepressant. And, you know, we see a lot of depressed patients who are, you know, maybe middle-aged or older. One of the first things to do is check their DHEA and give them a little more DHEA, and they just get a little bit of spring in their step.
Yeah. Well, DHEA is also the substance where all of our other hormones are synthesized, our estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. And women need testosterone, too, just like men. It's for vitality. It's for vitality and outlook and mood and all of that. Not surprising.
Right. Not to mention libido, which is, you know, it's an important lifestyle consideration, right?
Absolutely.
It's an important part of the overall health picture. I find DHEA can be very helpful. Actually, it seems to be more helpful in women than in men. Men may require a more, you know, like a bigger boost of something more potent like testosterone. Women respond to like subtle hormonal signals like, you know, 5, 10, or 20 milligrams of DHEA may provide them with a little bit more interest in sex. So
Terrific.
Good. Okay, so anyway, I don't have a big problem with her at 577. She says she's under the care of a good holistic doctor, and he's measuring levels, and he seems to be okay with it. So Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, we'll leave her on that.
Right, right.
All right. This one, a real simple question from, I can't see the name, it's LJ, I think. Can mastic gum kill H. pylori infection?
Mastic gum is supposed to be very good for H. pylori. H. pylori is the bacteria that usually causes ulcer, gastric ulcers, stomach ulcer, duodenal ulcer. We've had very good outcomes with mastic gum.
Yeah.
And the other side of that actually is it's a big question mark whether if H. pylori should be ridded at all. Should we get rid of it at all? Because maybe it's a commensal. Maybe it's a friendly critter who's going to live in the stomach. And often those who are, Dr. Hoppin, I think I'm raining on your parade a little bit about, but people who've been on antibiotic therapy to eradicate the H. pylori often wind up with GERD or acid reflux.
Yeah.
It becomes a problem.
There are some downsides, and you know, I've studied this. There's some downsides to H. pylori eradication. I think the problem with conventional medicine is they really love this find a bug, use a drug approach. And they're just fascinated with this new connection that we found between H. pylori and ulcers. And frankly, there is a slight connection between H. pylori and higher risk of gastric cancer. So on the basis of that, they've developed very powerful and profitable drugs to bomb H. pylori and eradicate it. Unnecessarily, because if you look at the world's population, about 60% of the world's population has H. pylori. In this country, it's less. We have more hygiene. We're now using drugs to get rid of it. We're testing for it. But in my opinion, the only time where it really is warranted to eradicate H. pylori is when someone has an ulcer that won't heal. You know, and the two types
that
of ulcers.
That would make sense.
Yeah, duodenal ulcers or gastric ulcers. A little higher up is gastric ulcer, duodenum is further down. But in GERD, which is a different thing, that affects the esophagus. It really is not helpful to kill off H. pylori, and it may actually cause more bloating, more gas, more belching, more fermentation, either higher up, or sometimes you trade the ulcer for irritable bowel syndrome. Lower down in your intestine, you may get diarrhea alternating with constipation with lots of bloating because you've killed off all your beneficial bacteria. So
yeah.
Other things that help H. pylori if you're trying to get rid of it, you know, it's not just the mastic gum is pretty effective, but also you can use, it turns out cranberry extract is actually pretty effective for that.
Oh.
Just, you know, just like cranberry helps urinary tract infections,
uh-huh.
Cranberry seems to help eradicate H. pylori. Fish oil seems to make a difference, probiotics, of course. There's a few other things in the arsenal against that. So,
And I suppose something like L-glutamine would help with the repair of the ulcer. Something like Endosin may also be helpful. If anybody's been through an antibiotic therapy to eradicate the H. pylori and now they have GERD, Endosin is often helpful with those symptoms.
Tell us a little bit about the product Endosin, because that's actually, you know, we have obviously a store at drhoffman.com. And many of our listeners tune in for health tips, but this is a kind of a hard-to-get supplement, as many of the things we mention are a little bit off the beaten track. So drhoffman.com is we have a store. We have we sell to the general public many of the self-same supplements that we make available to our patients. They're high-quality supplements that I personally curate, and we vet them very carefully, Layla and I, in terms of their effectiveness and purity and cost-effectiveness, and you can get online and order supplements at drhoffman.com. We also make a price promise. If you're not, if you find that a product, the very self-same product, is available somewhere else for cheaper, we'll match that price. So that's our price commitment. So what other things might we look at in terms of, and we're talking about Endosin.
Endosin, yes.
Yeah, talk about Endosin because that's only available through doctors, so don't look for it, usually at a health food store.
We've had wonderful outcomes with that, especially for those with intractable GERD, you know, that reflux that just doesn't go away no matter what they do. And Endofen has a lot of different ingredients in it. It's got arabinogalactans and some EGCG, maybe some marshmallows, slippery elm. All of these are emollient as well as healing to the GI tract.
So they sort of lubricate the mucous membranes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And taking a daily dose of that, two tablespoons in water, generally twice a day between meals, is a good place to start. And we've gotten very, very good outcomes with that.
Yeah, it really is a unique product because it's not, mm-hmm. many supplements are just pills or, you know, this is actually a powder that dissolves in water and coats and heals the esophagus. So many of our patients with GERD really do well with
DGL,
it.
And DGL,
of course. Yeah, the DGL lozenge. Yeah. And I think, you know, again, let me emphasize DGL. A lot of people say, well, I've taken DGL and it doesn't work. Well, how did you take the DGL? Well, I took one twice daily and... You know, I took it with meals with my other supplements. Well, that's not how you take it. It's actually the way to use DGL is the way some people suck on Lifesavers all day long or chew gum. Between meals, you pop a DGL lozenge in your mouth, and you can take 6 or 8 of those babies every day, and that will provide healing licorice extract to your irritated stomach lining or esophageal mucous membranes. And that's a great healing agent, but people just don't use it consistently enough.
That's true. And there are other people who actually misinterpret it. DGL is deglycerized licorice, meaning it's not going to raise your blood pressure.
Right.
It's deglycerized. The glycyrrhizic acid is removed. It's not going to impact blood pressure in any way, shape, or form. It's very safe to take for those who have hypertension or are on blood pressure medications as well. So it's good.
Yep.
It's wonderful.
Good stuff. All right, we have time for one more question, and this is from Rich, an avid listener of Health Talk for years. He says, Dr. Hoffman, I will be traveling on a Caribbean cruise in October, making stops at places like Aruba, Panama, and Costa Rica. Do you recommend that I get any specific vaccinations for this trip? So let me answer this from a medical standpoint first. I brought this up because it's not just about vaccinations. It's about, you know, what are some of the things you want to do to make it less likely that you're going to get sick on a trip or a cruise. You know, with all the, you know, all these, you know, I almost every week you hear about a cruise ship that you know, had to abort its cruise because 200 people got some kind of horrible diarrheal infection. I mean, these cruise ships these days seem to be like petri dishes for various types of bad bugs. And then, you know, you go to these foreign locales and maybe you want to try some exotic food. So, you know, what are some of the tips that we have for travelers? But in terms of the vaccinations, that's easy. If you're going on a Caribbean cruise, I mean, these cruises are really well organized. So you just call the cruise ship organization and you ask them, you know, do I need any vaccines to go to Aruba, Panama, and Costa Rica? Now, those places are actually pretty civilized places. And it's not like you're going to, you know, some place in deep, dark Africa where they have malaria or yellow fever, you know, where you need very special either medication prophylaxis or you need a special vaccine because you're going into the wilderness. These are, you know, popular tourist destinations. And, you know, it's very unlikely you're going to get sick. Well, one thing I will comment on is that when you go further south like this, you can get bitten by mosquitoes that can give you something like dengue fever. Unfortunately, there is no vaccine. There's no current preventive treatment for that. And occasionally people who go to these beautiful countries, especially Costa Rica, I've heard, perhaps also Panama, they can get a terrible case of dengue fever. And there's nothing in the world you can do to prevent that. I mean, except, you know, sleep in a mosquito net and make sure you're, you know, covered with mosquito repellent. But that's usually when you go off the beaten track, you know, sitting in your stateroom on a boat, you're less likely to be exposed to these mosquitoes. So, you know, what do you recommend when you have a nutrition patient who says, hey, I'm going, you know, whatever, to Mexico or I'm going to Thailand and I'm concerned that I might get a bug? What are some of
take your probiotics with you.
Thank you. Yes.
And don't wait till you get there to start taking them. I would start taking them now.
Good.
And my favorite is the Dr. O'Hara's Essential Formula. That travels so very well.
Because you don't need to refrigerate it, yeah.
Right? You don't have to refrigerate it. It really does its job. I've heard many cases firsthand where people thought they were starting to get some foodborne illness, and they increased their intake to about 6 pills a day of the Dr. O'Hara's, and they do very, very, very well. It's wonderful. I would never travel without it.
And what's the theory on why that might work? I mean, it's not an antibiotic. In fact, it's a probiotic. So why could that conceivably have any impact on gastrointestinal function?
Well, our immune system, most of our immune system is in the GI tract, and the beneficial bacteria is often helpful. And by re-inoculating our GI tract with those good beneficial bacteria, those good probiotics over and over, keeps us well, helps to keep us well, and reduces the incidence of foodborne illness. It doesn't make you completely immune. We would love that, wouldn't we? But
absolutely.
Then you wouldn't be able to eat or drink anything.
Right. And just one other aside, is if you go on one of these trips and you're on one of these potent acid blockers like Prevacid, Prilosec,
ooh,
Nexium,
mm-hmm,
these are medications that kill your stomach acid, and they render you more susceptible to infections with exotic bugs.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, maybe some people can't do anything about this. They can't get off their medications because they have a really strong medical reason for being on them. But what this argues for is these people were told, well, you need to be on this medication for the rest of your life. The vast majority of people don't really need to be on these medications, because with the right kind of diet therapy, the right kind of supplements, they can get rid of their GERD, they can get rid of their heartburn, their ulcers can be permanently healed, and they won't have a lifetime overdependency on these strong acid-blocking drugs. They're called proton pump inhibitors, but they absolutely kill your stomach acidity, and your stomach acidity is actually your natural defense against infection.
Absolutely, yeah. So, and those are the reasons where those who are on PPIs for many, many years, our stomach acid is also the stuff that digests our food, our protein primarily. So we're not digesting well. We may be getting indigestion. We may get more constipation or more bloating. It's changing the pH balance of the GI tract to something that allows an opportunistic bacteria to grow. So that's why those people are more at risk down the road as well, not just during that cruise or travel.
Great. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for questions on today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest has been Leila Mudin, Hoffman Center nutritionist, and you're welcome to consult with both of us or with her alone. One of the more economical pathways into complementary and alternative medicine is to see a complementary nutritionist like Leila, and she is part of our staff at the Hoffman's, actually our vast staff of two, because, you know, we our operation at the Hoffman Center is very simple. You know, it's a medical doctor, nutritionist team, and that's the way that we approach health problems. And patients seem to like it because, you know, after, you know, thoroughgoing medical workup, they can then go down the hall and they can get specific nutritional protocols, nutritional advice, what to buy at the market, what to eat, what to cook, what to have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And that, I think, is really what is a very, very potent force for change when you get a specific dietary protocol.
Yep, from the stethoscope to the fork.
Well said. All right. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank
I'm
you.
Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks, Leila. And this
Thank
is
you.
The Intelligent Medicine Podcast.